Welcome to NeuroNoodles, Neurofeedback, the Neuropsychology Podcast, featuring tech legend Jay Gunkelman. He is the man who has read well over 500,000 brain scans. Our goal is to provide information and promote options for better mental health. The NeuroNoodle Podcast is supported by listeners and businesses just like you, like our gold supporter, Applied Neuroscience, and our silver supporter, Mind Media. Earn up to 16 CEU hours by attending Applied Neuroscience's NeuroGuide Workshop March 4th and 5th in Madeira Beach, Florida. It's led by none other than Dr. Robert Thatcher himself. There are two ways you can attend, online or in person, with the link appliedneuroscience.com/attend-ng-workshops. Mind Media, get the latest EEG and neurofeedback technology from mindmedia.com. Their semi-dry sensor cap is a wonder to see, and their EEG amplifiers have been trusted in the field for decades. Their neurofeedback and QEG courses will get you up to speed in no time. Visit mindmedia.com now.
Two. Done.
Yeah, it's their right to be an idiot, but it's damaging. And you know, you've seen them. I mean, they preposition and they come in for maximum force at the base of the jaw and base of the skull. Slapping their face, but they're basically
Let me share this again and just unfortunately watch this dumb thing. Let's see.
Done.
Boom. And if you watched his head, it basically has a lateral and vertical. It kind of went up and back, and that's essentially putting all the torque into the brainstem, and when that happens, you end up with the fencing position, which is actually something that goes back to newborns. There's a reflex. It's a brainstem reflex, which is why you see it when you get the brainstem whacked like that.
Well, they call it fencing because it's like the on guard position.
Exactly. Okay. One arm is extended, one arm is contracted, and you look towards the hand that's extended. So it's kind of the on guard, position. But it's elicited as a reflex in newborns. Okay. If you have a newborn laying on its back and you turn its head to one side, the head to that side, that arm will go out, the other arm will come in. And it'll do that for about 5 weeks worth of development. Beyond that, it starts to not work. If you have cortical overlay on top of the brainstem that's working, you start to defeat the brainstem reflex. But when you're a newborn, they test all sorts of reflexes to check levels of function in the brain and the extent of development. The Babinski, where they strike the base of the foot to see if the toes go up or down. The snouting reflex, that if you push at the base of the nose, they go kind of, it's a snouting reflex. Again, they turn the head to the side and they get the fencing reflex. And it's a tonic reflex, and it's seen in head injuries really commonly. There was a study in 2009, and they looked at YouTube videos of people that were knocked out. And apparently there's a lot of them because they had a large N, the percentage that they had, 2/3 of the people that were knocked out ended up having a fencing reflex. 2/3. So this is not an uncommon or rare event, but it has to be a knockout. It can't be, this isn't a concussion side effect. This is, you've been knocked out. And so if you look at the brain activity in somebody that has that kind of an injury, you end up seeing epileptiform discharges. That the knockout itself has a gigantic discharge. And I hate that how they found out that. They basically had animal studies where they, whacked with a certain amount of force in various directions and so forth on heads of dogs. But they observe basically an epileptiform discharge with a significant trauma. That said, if a child is hospitalized after a head injury, they have about a 5 to 10% chance of having status epilepticus within the first week of hospitalization. And quite often they give a prophylactic application of an anticonvulsant with significant head injury. And with significant head injury, they put you into a barbiturate coma and wait for the brain to recover some so that you don't waste energy on maintaining consciousness and trying to be active again when your brain needs to use its resources basically to heal.
So Jay, unfortunately, the slap fighting thing is out there. And if you don't put it out there to let people know, hey, when you see that fencing response, you better go get checked out, right? Yeah. And the other thing is, I guess...
And this isn't just Will Smith.
Yeah, yeah. but it's happening in the schools.
This slap fighting... They're positioning themselves. They're getting the right angle and everything to do the maximum damage. This wasn't a little take your glove off and go slap. This is the try to knock your opponent out with a slap in the side of the face. And if you don't knock them out and you continue slapping back and forth, you've seen the damage to
what's the droopy face all about? I'll put the picture up here later, but what's happening there?
Well, if you whap the side of your head, you've got the trigeminal nerve coming out of the socket where your jaw is, and that runs the face. And I don't know if you've ever seen anybody with an injury to that, but basically it looks like they've had a stroke on that side.
Yeah.
And you can also suffer stroke-like phenomenon with head injury, post-traumatic ischemia. Ischemia is a decrease in the availability of oxygen and glucose. And because the brain swells, and it can't swell out. I mean, some people get a swelled head, but it doesn't really swell. It compresses, and that compression has to squeeze something, and the something is the blood vessels. So if you get you were a kid, you kinked a hose before, didn't you?
Yeah.
Well, doesn't that kind of start to influence the flow? If you kink it totally, you can stop the hose at the other end that they were squirting you with, So when you get enough pressure inside the head, it gives you post-traumatic ischemia. Migraine ischemia is a vascular headache, and the pounding headache after a head injury is an ischemic headache. It's not a migraine. Quite often it'll be described as a migraine. In fact, in the clinical setting, people will ask, do you have a history of headache? And if they say, yes, I've got migraine, I always ask, did it start after a head injury? Because that's not a migraine. That's post-traumatic ischemia. And the ischemia can last you can actually have long-term ischemia after a head injury because you tried to put the area back online too early. If you know, the swelling is what's compressed the blood vessel, and if downstream you're not getting as much flow, and you create a big demand for blood flow, and it can't get supplied, what you cause is hypoxia. The level of oxygen perfusion drops down, the PO2 drops down, and that causes hypoxia, which causes edema. Edema is more pressure. So if you put the area back to work too early before the vasculature is healed up, you can actually cause a worsening of the ischemia. If you keep doing it to your own detriment, glutamate cascade and cell death downstream happen, kind of like the downstream end of a stroke, the cell death that can end up happening due to the hypoxia, anoxia, glutamate cascade. And basically the cell, glutamate's an excitatory neurochemistry, and the cell overexcites without the ability to have oxygen, and it dies. So if you don't want to have cell death, and it's just as bad as it sounds, you know, having cell death doesn't sound like a good option. No. You know, it's not. That's why in a high school football game or a basketball game, if there's a concussion, you know, there's track, I mean, whatever sport there is, you can get whacked in the head. Even just running down the hall in school, I mean, people end up with head injuries. But after a head injury, you have to let the recovery occur, or you can end up with permanent problems from it that are not retrievable. Cell death doesn't exactly sprout a bunch of new cells. I mean, the brain does end up having cells that will convert to new neurons. It isn't like you can't recover function even after a stroke, but that's a whole bunch of stuff you should avoid. You know, rest up after that head injury, and the assessments that have to be done have been, you know, kind of underdone. It's nice to have a baseline study. Right. Some of them are just biobehavioral, like a CPT task, you know, go, no go kind of a task, basically to see if you've got omission errors or commission errors, what your reaction time's like, what the variability in your reaction time is like. And that information, yeah, as a baseline, then can be used to see whether the whack in the head has made you, you know, unable to track stuff properly or respond badly, or your reaction time's off. And if you can't get a good CPT back after a head injury, you shouldn't be back on the field. And that's kind of a really, really super simple little screening. But there's, you know, having a baseline EEG, so if there's a really significant injury that you can end up seeing when they should go back on the field after a more significant injury.
One unfortunate sport is football. And is it true or not that you get hit in the front and your brain sloshes to the back? And when that sloshes back there, that's where the problems come from. And in this case, this is a side to side. And I don't know if you're ready for some bad art, but what is the difference between getting hit front on and then side to side?
Actually, brains that twist with a side, you saw his head. It wasn't just that it went like some Egyptian move, you know, to the side. It went to the side and twisted. And the torsional force ends up tearing neurons. In the brain, you have some neurons that are very long, the longitudinal fasciculus, superior and inferior longitudinal fasciculus, the connections between the hemispheres that go through the corpus callosum, all the way from one side, all the way to the other side of the brain. The longer the pathway is, the more likely it's going to be torn if things twist. If you've got a little tiny pathway, it's going to kind of move with it. But if you got a long pathway and it gets twisted, if you, the brain does not like stretch. And if you stretch a neuron, the myelin ends up not liking it. You can end up having the cells die. And if you kill a white matter cell, it isn't the only one to go. There's a retrograde degeneration. Cells that were hooked to that cell, that were part of a network, that cell going will kill off other cells that were associated with it. And that takes sometimes 6 months to a year for all of those other cells to all, you know, finally degrade. So you can see progressive loss of function with serious head injuries. And in a concussion, if it's just gray matter, you're not really dealing with these white matter cracks, but a more serious head injury has more white matter involvement. Dr. Thatcher did a very nice study in the 1997 publication, and he was congratulated by Dr. Neuer, of all people, for the quality of the additional research knowledge for traumatic brain injury. He did a quantitative MRI, which looked at gray matter and white matter quantitatively, and quantitative EEG correlation, and found that if it's gray matter injury, it's alpha and beta that's influenced. If it's white matter that's injured, it's slow waves. So basically what most people would consider delta, but it can be rhythmic slow and be considered theta. And if you look in the traumatic brain injury discriminant, the severity index, half of the metrics in it are delta and theta. If you look at the determination of mild traumatic brain injury, there's only one theta metric. Everything else is alpha and beta. But they're deliberately not looking for serious head injuries because it's a mild traumatic brain injury discriminant. If it's a serious injury, it's not appropriate to run it. And it requires a normal EEG. And with a serious head injury, your EEG is quite often not normal. It takes time to recover and to have a normal EEG.
So this poor guy that got slapped and he went down, what happened? Like he was knocked out. He got consciousness again. Obviously, he's getting care. What are the steps that are going on there to make sure there isn't further damage and then to assess the damage?
Sure. If you're dealing with something where somebody has had head injury and they've been knocked out, it's appropriate to end up having medical testing. The thing you want to rule out for sure is a bleed. Now, I'm not talking about a little bit of blood product in the brain from a little micro tears of something. I'm talking about a subdural hematoma, an epidural hematoma, a subarachnoid. I mean, depending upon where the bleed is, a subdural hematoma, you can actually live for a significant period of time. Some people get them and they're there chronically. An epidural, or a subarachnoid, you're basically, you've got hours, if that. If you're knocked out in the ring, basically in boxing or MMA, they basically are, usually they get together enough to stand up and stagger out with the crew. But they're taken by ambulance to a hospital and they're scanned. And
is it MRI CAT scan? Like
in fact, it's neuroimaging. Ideally, an MRA can be done, magnetic resonance angiography, which is an MRI with a different kind of software to analyze it. It's the same kind of image. It's just, you know, done for a different purpose, with the physicist who's playing with the image ends up looking deeper in the brain, down at the brain stem, the circle of Willis, that allows the blood vessels that come up, the carotid on one side of your neck and the carotid on the other side, and the vertebral basilars coming up the back of your neck, they all end up having a circle that they end up going into of communicating arteries, little pieces, but it's called the circle of Willis as an entire group. And that basically, if you have a bleed that deep in the brain, they better find it quick because a bleed into the brainstem is not going to take long to take you out. If they catch it really, really quickly, they can save your life. So with distinct loss of consciousness in a sport or in an injury, an accident, falling down a stair, whatever, if you've been knocked out, it's time to be evaluated. Now, sometimes you go to the hospital and they'll check you out and they'll decide that this was a little too minor. The loss of consciousness was a very brief. There's no sequelae, some after effect, dizziness, nausea, et cetera, they if they don't see evidence of a concussion, even though there was some head trauma, that head trauma and brain trauma aren't the same thing. You can hit my head, but if my brain doesn't bounce around somehow, that's a head trauma, not a brain trauma. But even what looks like a fairly minor blow to the head sometimes can have the brain twist or bump into a structure that can tear a blood vessel. And at that point, you've got problems.
He got hit on the right side of the face. Is there any difference being the trauma on the right side of the head versus the left, or it's the same twisting? It doesn't matter.
It's the same twisting. It's entirely possible to have a brain bleed even at a distant location if the brain has moved. Blood vessels don't like to be stretched and torn either. And if you have a direct concussion from a deceleration injury, the brain actually goes forward and then backward. And because something, they're going together and this stops, the brain's going to keep going and hit forward. There's a lining, the dura matter between the hemispheres is called the falx cerebri. And the falx cerebri in an infant is soft and pliable and flexible. And by the time they're our age, it's like shoe leather. And if your brain moves forward and hits this very tough membrane, you can end up having the anterior connections between the right and left hemispheres damaged and decrease the relationship mathematically between function right and left frontally, coherence. Barry Sternman uses comodulation, which is more like a correlation. Coherence is a little bit more complex than a simple correlation.
That guy that got whacked, he's probably in his 20s, 30s. I would think his brain is more developed than the kids that in school are doing this, unfortunately. If you're in school and your brain's not mature and you get that slapping and in the twisting, is there a different type of damage that can happen when you're younger versus older?
Couple of things. When you're younger, you actually tolerate trauma in a better way than somebody who's aged. Now, somebody in their 30s isn't really aged, but as you start to get older and your brain has a little bit of atrophy, there's more room to bounce around and twist around in there. And the brain shouldn't be twisting and shouting. That's an old, the old dance thing, but this is not what the brain should be doing in there. In elderly people that have had their head hit need to be checked even more carefully. They end up having a high probability of a bleed. My father slipped and fell, went back to Fargo for Thanksgiving, and slipped and fell. And they went, he got his eyebrows stitched up and they x-rayed his shoulder and arm, but nothing was obviously wrong, but they didn't CT his head. And he was back in Arizona near Christmas time, just before Christmas, and football season going on, and I called and to chat, and he was having trouble understanding me, and he couldn't really speak fluently, and I learned to speak from this guy, so he was a real blabbermouth, and he wasn't able to put words together, and I'm starting to think, Wernicke's area, Broca's area, what part of the brain's involved and what's going on. And at first I thought he must have had a stroke, but then I realized, oh God, he fell Thanksgiving time. Weeks ago, this is a subdural hematoma and it's gigantic. And I had him put my mother on the phone. I told her, yeah, I'm writing an email, print it, take it with you to the ER. And I got a call about an hour or so later. And she said, the doctor wants to speak with you. Here's a phone number. So I dial the phone number and it's the hospital switchboard. They patch me through to his headset in surgery. They're draining 160 something cc's, about the size of a fist, out from inside of his head. And there's not that much room in there. The CT scans from there basically showed a 2 centimeter deviation of the midline. All the ventricles were collapsed. He bare. I've seen people with a subdural hematoma a third that size die from it. I've never seen anyone recover from one that size. And the neurosurgeon wanted to know, how do you diagnose a subdural hematoma on the phone? I said, well, you don't. You use an MRI or a CT scan, obviously. This is a parlor trick. I hang out with neuroscience folks, and this was a good guess. He says, good guess. I could have drilled the holes to drain this sucker, based on your email, and not done anything different than I did with the CT scan. You told me exactly where and what size and everything this was going to be. So he sent me the images, and after the drainage, and then the next day there was a little bit more fluid, a little more blood, and he put in a shunt, a hematoma shunt, and they wheeled him from the surgery to implant the shunt to the X-ray to show the shunt in place. And that image was sent straight to me the same time as it was sent to the doctor. And I'm looking at the image. I expect to see some long line or a donut circle with one of these transections, and they're just not there.
So Jay, the poor soul that got knocked out, he went to the hospital, I'm guessing, to get a scan, and let's just say they didn't find a bleed, but you say he has a two-thirds chance of getting a concussion because he got knocked out.
And at that point, they may not have a bleed, but if the brain is slightly swelled, they have ischemia. And that's the pounding headache, and it's dysfunction. It's almost like having a small stroke. It's a small vessel ischemia, not a large vessel ischemia. But you can have difficulty finding words, you can have difficulty with comprehension. You can have difficulty with perception and memory, confusion. All of those kinds of things can happen with a simple concussion, as though there's anything such as that. And the difficulty is, you can imagine a tinker toy network of connections, and you hit the head, and a couple of the little spokes or hubs have been damaged. Well, you can route around it, you can put yourself back together functionally. Have a second or a third head injury start to chip away at, if you lose a couple of what's called rich club hubs, important intersections where a lot of networks are tapped together, if you lose one of those, it's really difficult to put together the function that you've lost. Sometimes virtually impossible. Without specialized interventions. So post-concussion headache is an indication of significant ischemia. And if that's the case, rest, 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 rest. And also lecithin and vitamin E are important. They help with cell membranes. You don't want to end up having a poor diet, starving your body of some of the nutrients that it needs for some of the healing that's going to happen. But it takes time. With a concussion, you have to think seriously about whether you're setting yourself up for major problems if you put yourself into the same situation again. And in sports, repeated head injury, how many times does a lineman get slapped upside the head? Well, pretty much every play,
Right.
First move,
Yeah.
There's, hundreds, probably thousands of head injuries, some of which may be, enough to have given them a bit of a concussion. And chronic traumatic encephalopathies, CTE, has been, popularized with a movie about it being discovered as a pathology in chronic injuries in sports. And what a controversial circumstance. I mean, a bazillion-dollar sport that really would just as soon do what it's been doing and not have to think about these things ends up having to respond in a healthful way in a sport that's inherently dangerous and unhealthy in some way. So, it's a fun.
Earn up to 16 CEU hours by attending Applied Neurosciences NeuroGuide Workshop March 4th and 5th in Madeira Beach, Florida. It's led by none other than Dr. Robert Thatcher himself. There are two ways you can attend, online or in person, with the link appliedneuroscience.com/attend-ng-workshops.
Online.
In that incident, Jay, you wouldn't do a concussion protocol, would you? Because you see that stance.
Yeah.
Is there any way somebody could go back into a game after they've had the?
No.
Yeah,
no.
You're right.
No.
So that's
a brainstem hit.
Anybody sees that, it's like you don't need to know anything else. Don't go back in.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. This is a do not pass go. This go straight to the hospital.
Right. So if this poor guy wants to go back and get slapped around again, what are they going to check to say, okay, if you want to do it, you can go back and do it? What's the time frame?
Even in boxing, if you've been knocked out, there's a protocol in boxing. There's a certain amount of time, and you've got to go through some special examinations and whatnot in order to get certified to be able to go back in and get your head beat in again. So, but it's inherently dangerous. And the people who sponsor MMA are sponsoring these slap fights right. at this point as a sport. Well, geez, what the hell kind of sport is slapping somebody? I mean, apparently it's a popular sport. And again, you get kids who don't know the nature right. of the damage that they can cause. It's not just getting a red face. You can lose an eye as a simple thing, just a real simple thing, losing an eye. And let me tell you, losing an eye is not inconsequential. I mean, 3D is really nice, and it goes kind of 2D on you without the second eye.
Especially if you're reading EEG scans 500,000 times.
Yeah, well, luckily I still got the one that still works, And EEG is not 3D, is 2D, So,
well, people are going to say, why are you promoting this sport? And it's not promoting the sport as much to me as it is, hey, look, whatever it takes for people to watch to say, look, this is something serious to know, like teaching somebody what a stroke looks like. Okay, here's a concussion. Yeah. This is what it looks like. It's a dumb sport. Don't advise it. Kids are doing it in school. If any kids see somebody get knocked out like that, tell somebody. It's serious, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And if you've had a brainstem trauma, and that's a brainstem reflex that they elicit, the fencing, again, that's without the cortical influence and a brainstem insult, you end up looking towards the arm that's extended, kind of like you'd be looking towards the person that you were sticking your sword at, and the other arm is pulled in, like you have the other arm pulled in, not waving around when you're fencing. So it's appropriately described as a fencing posture. But again, this is a reflex. It's a brainstem reflex. And if you've had a brainstem insult, it's time to be checked. This isn't a subtle thing. The brainstem has things like maintaining respiration, foundational regulatory systems. So you can't be damaging the brainstem without potentially having long-term, really serious consequences.
Is the term posturing, like, what's the difference between a fencing response and then posturing?
Well, posturing can be lots of things. If you've had your cortex whacked, you can end up having rigidity, without necessarily having the fencing position, but just rigidity, and that's decorticate rigidity. And you know, if you whack the brain, glia can end up essentially having a spreading depression and shut things down. And it's a temporary unconsciousness because the glia basically pulled the plug on brain activity. If the glia create an electro positive potential in the basal membrane of your cortex, that cortex area is shut off. And if it goes electronegative, it's on. So a whack basically ends up having things go. Calcium wave, basically, electropositive. That's a what's called a spreading depression, when the spot that's hit, that spreads from that spot across the cortex.
He comes out of it. He runs the risk later in life to have, you know, is it plaque buildup or what?
Let's assume that he's been hit enough to end up with a concussion on top of his brainstem twitch that he had that put him out. Ischemia ends up having its own appearance in the brain. It's not healthy. Chronic traumatic encephalopathy has local ischemia to the point where the cells in the area have died, and you end up with necrosis. If you've ever seen the scans, kind of a brown black rot in an area of a brain that should be kind of pinkish. It's really not healthy. Deliberately getting yourself knocked out isn't exactly a deliberately good sport. But like I say, people do things that are sporting. I raced motorcycle with sidecar.
Right.
You know, you've got to be crazy to do that. I have to admit, that's one of the most dangerous things you can do. It can end up going, cartwheeling with a motorcycle and sidecar kind of forming a triangle with people flying off in every direction. And, if you turn to the right, you can't lean into the turn because the motorcycle sidecar is there. That guy's got to lean way out to give you the counterbalance so you can turn to the right. Jumping around on a platform on a motorcycle racing next to other people who are doing the same foolish thing is pretty dangerous stuff.
So Jay, let's just say there's no MRI and all there was Jay Gunkelman and his Nexus 32 channel headset. Would the swelling get in the way for you to read the scan, or like what do you think you would see on?
In fact, ischemia is really easily identifiable. Critical care medicine has actually declared QEG to be sensitive and helpful for looking at ischemia, identifying the ischemia, tracking the therapeutic change in the ischemia. Ischemia is essentially seen as the slow edge of the alpha band, usually starting to intrude into the theta frequency band, depending upon exactly how fast your alpha was. But the slow edge of alpha ends up being the indication of ischemia. If there's white matter damage and it's a severe injury, you'll have the slow edge of alpha from the ischemia and slow focus where the white matter has been damaged. And the EEG is very sensitive to the occurrence of traumatic brain injury. It's not necessarily specific, however. And that ends up being part of the arguments in court. And of course, an adversarial circumstance, it's not a science circumstance. Right. It's are adversarial, and people argue back and forth about whether the EEG is showing one thing or another, and whether you should be doing it at all. But that's court. If you're actually worried about your kid or your parent, an EEG ends up being a useful measurement of brain function. It can identify the ischemia. It can track the progress of therapies. Now, if you've had a head injury and you've got post-traumatic ischemia, one of the very, very helpful things is hyperbaric oxygen. You know, ischemia is an inability to deliver oxygen and glucose. Well, you can taper the oxygen by getting into a hyperbaric, it's 1.3 atmospheres of pressure with oxygen. And at that point, oxygen doesn't have to go along a bloodstream to get into a cell. It's perfusing directly through your tissue. Once it's inside you, it basically perfuses directly through tissue. So it doesn't have to flow. It invades cell to cell to cell. It ends up basically helping heal the ischemic area by providing appropriate level of oxygen to the area.
The brainstem injury, the twisting, what do you think would be a symptom that would happen that neurofeedback could help correct that to create a new pathway? Because, I mean, brainstem, that's way back there. What, you got the cerebellum back there? And what can neurofeedback do to help if you see something on the EEG?
In fact, if the EEG shows a deviation, the EEG can be operantly trained. If you can teach a dog to sit, you can teach the brain to make more or less of a rhythm. It's simple operant training. Now, there's some benefit to just providing feedback. Systems theory tells you that if you provide feedback in a system, the system can then self-regulate and change state. There's some behaviors during the training and neurofeedback that behave like systems theory would predict, a sudden change of some sort. But there's a lot of it that looks quite operant. And the classic training with Sturman and Camilla was more of an operant approach than systems theory, that's for sure.
I can't wait to see what the next sport that comes out, Jay, that sheds some light on mental health awareness.
Remember the Three Stooges would do the eye poke. Maybe that'll be the next one, you know? So.
Well, it's the clinicians and the neurologists are going to keep busy with this one.
Unfortunately. You know, and the kid things on YouTube that they pick up are something that the sunflower seizure.
What's a sunflower seizure?
They look at the sun, which is not really a good thing in the first place, but then they move their fingers back and forth like the petals on a sunflower. and the flickering light, some have seizures. And so they because this is a thing on YouTube to do the sun, you know, look at the sun and flash your fingers in front of it, and some kids have a seizure. They've actually coined the term sunflower seizures in the EEG tech world and epileptology. It's not a historic term that's been around a long time. It's a new term that came out because of a YouTube, you know, increase in the number of photo flash induced seizures.
So they drop and they seize, and then it takes time to.
Yep. You've just triggered a seizure. And, you know, some people, photo flash will create a seizure, but not that many. In a lab, the photic stimulation is considered an activator for seizures, but you only get a 4% additional yield above and beyond the base eyes open, eyes closed EEG. If you want to evoke a higher incidence or high probability of seeing a seizure discharge in somebody that's known to have a seizure, you can sleep deprive them. And when you've been sleep deprived, you didn't recover from the wear and tear of the day before, and you're also in and out of levels of consciousness in transitional states, not wide awake, not all the way asleep. Transitional states, transients in the EEG tend to happen. You're not in one stable state, you're not in another stable state, and in between, the discharges tend to occur.
And you can train that symptom away as well. It just could be a lot of training.
It depends. Everybody's got their own learning curve, you know.
Yeah.
But there's a basic learning curve for the EEG. It's considered a fifth order learning curve. And let me do a little bit of really bad art here.
I've been waiting for this bad art, Jay.
So we've got amplitude, and let's say we're doing an alpha training, and the person's got a certain level of alpha, and then this is time, and time is multiple sessions or multiple hours, and what you see is that there's an initial increase, and then there's a decrease, and then there's an increase, and then there's an exponential increase. This is habituation. I mean, you walked in the door, you might have normally been here at home, chilled out, but you walked in the door, there's a guy with a white coat, you know, the whole white coat effect. They're putting electrodes on your head. The last thing you remember about that was like some Frankenstein movie with sparks flying off of things. So, you know, your alpha is a little lower than it might have been if you were just chilling out. And you get used to the white coat and the funny electrodes and paste, and that habituation to the experimental setting is an increase. And people that did very brief studies showed this nice statistical increase. But people that did studies a little longer started to have a difficult time replicating the alpha training effect. But this is active volition. I'm trying hard to relax. Well, like, that doesn't even make sense, you know? Come on. You can't try hard to do something like alpha. And eventually they learn passive volition, kind of the giving up to make it happen. And then when they really get that and they recruit lots and lots of alpha, there's an exponential increase in the alpha at the end. This is the basis of Jim Hart's PhD dissertation in 1974 out of Kamiya's lab. And, you know, they showed basically this to be multiple hours. And we took the same data back to our lab in North Dakota and looking at patients who, you know, this is a normal person in a training. Patients take longer. But they already knew patients took longer because in Germany, 4 hours of training on slow cortical potentials, a normal person can gain good control of it. an epileptic takes 40 hours, not four. So what we were finding wasn't 3.5, 4 hours like Jim Hart's data with normal folks, basically. Well, university people, how normal is that? That's another talk entirely. But we had clinical patients at a state hospital, and it was taking us about 14 hours. And, so it takes longer if you're not already doing fairly well in the first place. It takes longer to end up with this level of control. But you follow the same shape of the learning curve. It just takes longer.
Everything anyway, you want to know about slap boxing.
Well,
it's not even boxing. It's not even fighting. It's stand there and get knocked out.
The people that don't necessarily get knocked out end up having such destruction to their face. I mean, the tissue swells outside here too, not just inside. And they got like two sides of a face over here and one side on the other side. It was all swelled out, the eyes swelled shut, black and blue. You know, this is more damage than you see in MMA. In MMA, you're putting up, deflecting things and ducking. You're not standing there stoically waiting for somebody to whap you. It's kind of sub sport. It's not even sporting. The person's not defending themselves. They're not running. They're not hiding. They're just standing there. And
I believe you're only supposed to use the fingers. That you get the palm in there, and then lights out. It's
yeah. And you saw the guy positioning where he was going to hit. This caught that. So
that's not good.
No. And you saw his head up and twist, and the twist torque in the brain. You know, it's not the same exact, but if you're shot in the head, the chances of recovery are almost non-existent if it goes through the midline. If it stays in the same hemisphere, you have a chance of recovery. Giffords. I grew up with a kid who ended up attempting suicide with a gun stuck in his mouth, and he blew his eye and part of his frontal lobe, and got rid of his depression by blowing his frontal lobe away. Yeah. I saw him in the state hospital. I said, geez, hi, long time, high school friend. And here he is with one eye, all patched out like this.
Yeah. Yeah.
He recovered. But people that end up having something shot that goes through the midline, the recovery rate on that is essentially non-existent.
Well, Jake Gunkelman, thank you for another great NeuroNoodle podcast. We explained what happened. We don't condone it, but we do want you to recognize the warning signs, especially for the kids in school. So be careful out there, folks.
That's right. And on Zoom, no matter how upset Pete gets with me, he can't slap me, you see. So
I have to wait till Suson City in October.
That's right. This October. Yeah.
That's right.
Well,
you Martijn know, Arns.
Arns and Dirk DeRitter, too.
And Dirk,
and,
yep.
AI implants in the brain. I mean, there's going to be some interesting discussion. Dirk DeRitter actually invented pulse mode or burst mode stimulator. When they invent new implantable stimulators, he's with the implant engineers because he's the one who's wanting stuff implanted. And he's been trying to make the implants more and more and more like the brain itself. And that's why he would like to have an AI chip on the implant so that instead of having to pre-program a fixed chip discharge pattern, it can actually learn what the brain is doing and adapt appropriately. So anyway, there is a lot of advanced stuff. So
we'll put all the information here, October, Sioux Sun City.
See you there.
All right, Jay Gunkelman. Thank you, buddy.
Bye.
The NeuroNoodle Podcast is supported by listeners and businesses just like you. Like our gold supporter, Applied Neuroscience, and our silver supporter, Mind Media. Earn up to 16 CEU hours by attending Applied Neuroscience's NeuroGuide workshops in Madeira Beach, Florida. They're led by none other than Dr. Robert Thatcher himself. There are two ways you can attend, online or in person, with the link appliedneuroscience.com/attend. -NG-workshops. Earn up to 16 CEU hours. Sign up now at appliedneuroscience.com/attend-NG-workshops. Mind Media. Get the latest EEG and neurofeedback technology from mindmedia.com. Their semi-dry sensor caps is a wonder to see, and their EEG amplifiers have been trusted in the field for decades. Their neurofeedback and QEG courses will get you up to speed in no time. Visit mindmedia.com now.